Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa School of Social Work, offering the opportunity to earn a master's degree from anywhere in Iowa, including an all-online MSW program. Information at socialwork.uiowa.edu.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, hard to believe it's been nearly 5 months since we last checked in with Dr. Stanley Perelman. Perelman is a recognized researcher and authority on coronaviruses. He has a lab at the University of Iowa. He's an immunologist and microbiologist, has studied various coronaviruses. And remember, coronaviruses is a family of viruses. He studied coronaviruses for more than 40 years, including the SARS and MERS viruses, now COVID-19, also known as SARS-2. Dr. Perelman, thank you for making time in your busy schedule for us once again. Welcome back to our program.
Thank you for inviting me, Ben.
I wanted to get you to chime in or your views on this latest news. The federal government this week outlining a sweeping plan to make vaccines for COVID-19 available for free to all Americans. This is assuming a safe and effective shot is established and widely accepted. Reading a short excerpt from this AP report on this news item, here's the AP excerpt. In a report to Congress and an accompanying playbook for states and localities, federal health agencies and the Defense Department sketched out complex plans for a vaccination campaign to begin gradually in January or even later this year, eventually ramping up to reach any American who wants a shot. The Pentagon is involved with the distribution of vaccines, but civilian health workers would be the ones giving shots. That's one excerpt there. Dr. Perelman, what are your thoughts about this plan and the scale that will be needed for it to be effective?
Well, certainly there's a lot of logistical error things that have to be taken into consideration. I think that if it were to be pulled off and we would have a vaccine that was efficacious and safe and widely accepted, as you said initially, that would be great. That would go a long way to potentially stopping this pandemic. There's a lot of questions, of course, along the way here. Even if all those things were true, we don't know how long a vaccination immunity would last. Mm. We know that from our studies of various coronaviruses that immunity is often fairly short-lived, so we don't know would this be effective for weeks or months or years. We hope that it would be at least a year. We think that people who get the common cold coronaviruses are protected from a cold for at least a year. So we hope that that's what happens. In terms of the other steps, though, of course, we're not there yet because we haven't proven yet that these vaccines work well, and we haven't proven that they're safe. They're probably going to be safe is my best guess. How they work is they probably will all work to some extent, but then the public has the issue of having 5 or 7 vaccines to choose from. How will they know which one is best? There'll be all these studies going on concurrently. Certainly putting our efforts into several possible vaccines gives us a chance at the end to have the best of the possibilities rather than just betting on one. But there's really so many uncertainties here. And I think the main thing is the last part of your statement there, because people are worried about the vaccine. A lot of people say, well, why would I take this vaccine? I want to make sure it works. I want to make sure other people take it first. So this is a huge issue. And then you put that together with the decreasing trust that the American public has in the CDC and the FDA because of various political machinations. And it becomes a really unclear question how this is going to pan out in the end.
Mm-hmm. So are you saying what you mentioned there at the end, the polls showing skepticism remaining across America about this vaccine, in fact, increasing? I have poll results from an Associated Press poll taken back in May, which is quite a while ago now in this pandemic. Only about half of Americans, this is back in May, of those who said they wouldn't get vaccinated, the overwhelming majority said they were worried about safety. So we had half back in May saying they're worried about getting vaccinated for safety reasons. The polls, other polls showing that lack of confidence has worsened since May. So the chief obstacle here in overcoming this pandemic in our country, are you saying, is not really scientific. It's not really having to do with developing a vaccine and the logistics of distributing it. It's overcoming what has been created politically.
Yeah, I think that that's the first step, and certainly once that's overcome, I don't want to minimize the logistical issues that will have to be resolved to make sure everybody gets it and all communities are equally well served. So I think that both those things are really major hurdles. They're not impossible to get over if people take the vaccine. And initially, there's these trials of 30,000 with five different vaccines, and if they're all successful without safety and people are protected and they're shown to really protect against getting COVID-19, then I think some of the vaccine hesitancy will decrease. But, on one side, you have a situation where it feels like the CDC and FDA are politicized, and yet on the other hand, the American public is supposed to trust agencies which have been compromised in the popular perception about how objective they are. So it's really that to me is one of the problems. That's not the only problem, because I think once the vaccine is shown to be good and to be safe, then I think people will receive it in order to protect themselves and people in their families from getting COVID-19. But there's so many variables here, it's really hard to know how it'll actually play out in the end.
Right. Dr. Perlman, what percent, roughly, of Americans will need to get vaccinated over a period of weeks and months? This is a big, big program that will be rolled out when it happens. What percent of Americans have to get vaccinated in order to stop this pandemic?
Yeah, so I think it's not known for sure. The best guesses are 60 to 70%. There may well be in some places already may be up to 10 to 20% of people have been infected, so are the equivalent of being vaccinated. And we don't know things like if you've already had COVID-19, should you get vaccinated at that point? Is it safe? Those are questions we really don't know the answers to. The other thing I want to say is that some of the communities that are most hard hit by this pandemic are the ones who have the greatest vaccine hesitancy. So we know that minority communities, some of which have really been used as guinea pigs in the past for various medical experiments, are very, very skeptical about the vaccine, and they're more so than other populations. And they're the ones who may need it the most because they're often in positions where they can't avoid close contact with other people, they can't socially distance, where they may have poor access to health care. So right. there's a lot of issues, not just going out to your local friendly suburban town and giving vaccinations.
Right. And doing the math here, just roughly in my head, it doesn't seem to add up what you've given me. You say to effectively protect the nation from coronavirus, 60 to 70% of Americans must either be vaccinated or have their own immunity from fighting off of having the COVID infection themselves. But we have these polls that show only about half of Americans say they'd get vaccinated, perhaps less than half, because that confidence is worsening. So do the numbers add up for you, or does something have to change here in public attitudes?
Well, certainly the attitudes have to change. The other thing is that there's all these other issues that I think we all know about, so that if you're elderly or you have underlying immune problems, you're going to respond to the vaccine less well. So you won't be as protected. Yet those are just the people who are most susceptible to COVID-19. All these coronaviruses seem to have a predilection for infecting people who are older or have underlying diseases like diabetes, high blood pressure, obesity. So we know that for all of them, for the original SARS coronavirus, for the Middle East respiratory virus coronavirus, and this new SARS-CoV-2, these are the populations, these are just the folks who don't respond that well to vaccines.
In this program, do you know if there will be a prioritization of the people who will get it? I mean, the most vulnerable people get it first or not? Do you know?
Yeah, this is something I'm on some committees that have been discussing this for the last several months, and there's been really thoughtful considerations on these committees. So I think what the general feeling is that healthcare workers should be the first in line because they're the ones who, if they basically go down, then the whole system collapses for healthcare. Then the other hand, though, they're the ones who wear the most protective gear, so may have the least likelihood of getting infected, but they're still the first on the list. And then after that, we talk about very vulnerable populations, Americans who have comorbidities or are older, even though we know they may not respond as well, and then down to other people who are essential for the functioning of the society and the community, whether they be pharmacists or firemen or policemen, they all have their places in this list. So those are the kinds we're thinking about. Pregnant women they don't have worse outcomes than other women, but they seem to get sicker while they're during the acute phase. So, and then after that, the people who are 20 to 50 or some group like that, I think that's what it is, children would be the last ones to be vaccinated because they handle the infection best.
If you just joined us, my guest this half hour, Dr. Stanley Perlman of the University of Iowa, immunologist, microbiologist, really world authority. He's been on coronaviruses. He's been studying them for more than 40 years and is involved on this global team to get us a solution, to get us out of this pandemic. And just to remind our listeners, we've been talking about the federal government outlining a sweeping plan this week to make vaccines for COVID-19 available for free to all Americans, assuming a safe and effective shot is established and widely accepted. That vaccine is still being developed, of course. Back to this sort of playbook from the CDC, as you understand it, Dr. Perlman, when we look at this, this is, according to the campaign playbook, much larger in scope and complexity than seasonal influenza or other previous outbreak-related vaccination responses. So when this happens, no one alive today has experienced what we will experience in terms of a mass vaccination, or have they?
I'm trying to think. In the early days of the polio vaccination, I don't think we did it quite like this. I would say you're right. I think parts of the world that have had vaccinations like this, whether against polio or smallpox, people who are older will remember smallpox, the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. But those, again, were mostly children. So this is across all ages. I can't really think of a situation where we went across all ages and everybody was eligible to receive the vaccine and should receive the vaccine.
Mm-hmm. The president said this week in an ABC News town hall that the vaccine could be 3 or 4 weeks away. However, I think administration officials, perhaps CDC officials, made it clear to reporters after that remark that widespread availability would take months. What do you think of the president's assertion that a vaccine could be 3 or 4 weeks away? Just a political comment, not really based in what you're seeing?
Well, I think that the meaning of the words is what you have to pay attention to. So I think 3 or 4 weeks is too early, but I could imagine that in 8 weeks, there's going to be some evaluations maybe at the end of October. So maybe in 8 to 10 weeks, there'll be some vaccine and it'll be produced in amounts that maybe would be given to healthcare workers and other people high on the priority list. Mm-hmm. For larger amounts, there's no way that there's going to be that in numbers. But literally, the vaccine could be available in 8 weeks or a number like that, even if it wasn't widely available. So that's why the exact interpretation of the words is important here.
Yeah, it was interesting what you said a few minutes ago, that when this happens, we could have five or six vaccines that are out there because, and remind us of this, am I getting this right? We have millions of doses of various vaccines, of a handful of vaccines that have not been fully tested and approved. They are being mass produced right now at great cost. Most of them, a lot of them will be just incinerated, disposed of, but we're hoping that one of them is both effective and safe and will reach the population. Is that correct?
Well, an even happier outcome would be that they're all equally effective. They may have small differences, and that they all will be used, and people will be happy to accept any of them because they're different. But we don't know how well they'll compare. But what we're trying to do now is there's supposed to be centralized agencies that are getting data on all these vaccines, at least for safety, we'll be able to compare them. For actual efficacy, it's a little trickier because it really depends on whether the vaccinated people are exposed to a sufficient virus to know how well they do. So safety, but I would bet the safety issues are not hugely different. So it's possible that they will not have to be incinerated, that they'll all be useful. Of course, the other alternative is the one you mentioned, that one or two are clearly worse than the others, and then people will not want to take them, and they won't be useful.
Mm-hmm. Are you keeping track of these handful of viruses as they are marched through the testing and approval process? Do you have, as a scientist, as a researcher in this area, do you have a way of, like, looking?
Well, I'm on the committees that evaluate them, so I kind of am force-fed information about them, even if I wouldn't normally follow them extremely closely. So I know I know pretty closely about what I want to say, not quite all of them, but pretty close to all of them.
And all of them meaning how many?
I would say I know about four right now. I'm trying to think if I've heard about the others as well. Some of the others haven't quite gotten so far yet, but I expect that I will hear about them all pretty soon, because we're making recommendations, so we need to think about all the different vaccines.
And you're saying all of the ones that you know really intimately about up to this point all look good?
They all look, yes, they all look like they induce immune responses. So far, they all look like they're safe. So we don't know how this will all pan out, but certainly there's none that's acting very poorly. Which isn't a big surprise, because some of them have been used previously, some of the platforms, and others have been tested already in animals. So it's not a surprise that they're working to some extent. But there are some issues. Two of the most advanced vaccines are what are called RNA vaccines. So they have basically the molecule that allows proteins to be made in our cell, or that this particular set of viruses uses it for genetic information. And RNA is fairly labile, which means that if you let it sitting around in the wrong conditions, it'll be degraded. So the companies that are using RNA vaccines, and there's a lot of reasons to think that these vaccines will be very good, but the vaccines have to be stored under very, very cold conditions, and they have to be processed just right so that they're still working. So the companies doing this are aware of this. They're trying to set it up so that there won't be any failures because the vaccine is degraded. But if you send your vaccine off to a place where there's not the right facilities, people have to be very, very careful about using the vaccine and making sure that they use it under conditions that it still works.
We have about 5 minutes left of our conversation. A few other points. Dr. Perlman, what has been happening? You've mentioned you're on these key committees evaluating these vaccines that will hopefully get rid of this pandemic, assuming the public accepts that we went through that. What has been happening with your research in your lab at the University of Iowa in the past few months?
Yeah, well, so we are mostly working on trying to get animal models for the infection, and also doing work trying to understand the immune response in animals and in people. So much of this disease, as you probably know, is really a function of the immune system responding to the virus rather than the virus itself doing bad things. So that's why we've come to realize that we probably are going to need, in terms of therapy, if vaccines aren't available, what we're probably going to need is a combination of drugs that inhibit virus growth and yet at the same time make the immune response not be over excessive, because those are the two things together that we think are causing disease. We're trying to understand that more. And we're also trying to help with in the hospital, helping with people who are in the hospital with COVID-19 and understand something about the immune system in those people as well. So we have lots of different projects we're doing, and basically I think we're working harder than we have worked, and we're going crazier than we have in the past.
So your pace of work has been incredible since the beginning of the pandemic. I mean, you are working at full tilt.
Yeah, I don't think it's been a day since March 1st that I haven't come into work. And if I haven't come into work, it means I sit at home on my computer. That's an occasional Saturday. So I don't think there's a day that I haven't been here. And
well,
it's continuous.
I hear the applause from the listeners right now for your for your acts, Dr. Perlman. We're closing in on 7 million infected in the U.S., nearly 200,000 deaths. Talk about Iowa. We saw a spike in late August, early September here in Iowa when college students returned to campus. But other states have colleges and universities where students are returning. Why did Iowa gain a red zone status?
Well, I think there's probably a few features. One, we never really shut down, so we never really had a trough. So states in the Northeast had a huge peak in April, but they had a trough basically in the summer, and they may come back up again in September, October. So we never really had a trough. We were at a steady level. And then when students came back, for example, the University of Iowa did not do widespread testing. Other universities test every student twice a week. We're not doing any testing unless people want to be tested or unless they're ill. There's the bars in town have been closed and opened again. They're closed now, and I heard that the rest of the state bars are open as of today or tonight, but not Johnson County, which is a good thing because
Johnson and Story counties, yes.
Yeah, Johnson and Story, because they're the conduits for one way of spreading the infection. So we're having a lot of university-related infections. But, you know, even universities have tried hard. So University of Illinois really tried to do everything right, had lots of testing. They still had people who were not obeying the rules, not doing social distancing, so there were outbreaks. I suspect it's not as widespread as ours. The other thing about ours infection, so we have all these cases, but as far as I know, no student has landed in the ICU, and I don't even know if any have been hospitalized. So this shows, again, that for younger people, this is not an infection that's life-threatening for the most part, which on one hand is really good, but on the other hand may make people too lackadaisical about what they need to do, because certainly they go home and affect grandma or their older parents. It's bad.
All right. Well, we've run out of time, and this has been so enlightening the last 20 or so minutes again with you. We appreciate your very cramped schedule, making time for us to inform Iowa Public Radio listeners about your efforts, the efforts to end this pandemic. Dr. Stanley Perlman, immunologist, microbiologist, world authority on coronaviruses, working hard to end this pandemic. Dr. Perlman, we appreciate your time and this discussion. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Ben.
I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.